Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Refine by Nicole Vann, narrated by Shiromi Arserio. Prologue. Kinningsley, seat of the Viscounts Linwood, Herefordshire, England, July 21st, 1795. Timothy Linwood laughed. Had he known it would be the last time he would laugh, he would have savoured the moment more. Revelled in the joy bursting in his chest like so many champagne bubbles. Instead, he merely cringed when his voice cracked between childish giggle and manly guffaw. Such was life for a 14-year-old.
"Again, again, again!"
His 4-year-old sister Marianne jumped up and down, bouncing her dark curls, pudgy hands clapping. Smiling indulgently, Timothy placed the metal boat into a long basin of water set on the stone landing. He twisted the metal flywheel that was the ship's steering wheel, sending the boat churning through the water. Marianne's high-pitched laughter rang down the curved stairs and across the garden, but most disconcertingly, through the open French doors at Timothy's back. "Hush, Marianne, you will wake Mama." He tried for stern, but a wide grin belied his words. He darted a glance through the doors into the drawing room. Their mother was still asleep on the long chaise, an empty bottle of laudanum resting sideways on the small table beside her. She had already taken 2 full doses, though it was barely early afternoon.
"Again,"
Marianne nudged him and then giggled, stifling the sound behind her little hands. It had all been worth it. The hours constructing the ship, secreting away the materials, working by candlelight, breaking at least 21 different rules, all to see Marianne's face wreathed in smiles, banishing that pinched, too old look a child should never wear. Fortunately, their father wouldn't return from London until next week, and heaven knew Mama probably wouldn't be conscious before then. A few more days of precious freedom. He wound the boat. Marianne laughed, leaning forward with clasped hands, anticipation palpable. He released the mechanism and the toy sprang to life. Her excited squeals filled the air before she caught herself, covering her mouth again. Timothy lounged back on his heels, smiling broadly. The merriment felt good, lifting him from the inside out. Hydrogen in his veins, just like those newly invented hot air balloons he had read about. Quicksilver. But it was far too short-lived. "What is this, boy?" A deep voice came from the doorway behind him, the sound skittering down Timothy's spine. The boat gave a final sputter, bobbing to a stop. Timothy staggered to his feet and whirled around, unconsciously placing a protective hand on Marianne's tiny shoulders, and then looked up, 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 into his father's impassive gaze. Lean and dark-haired, Charles, Viscount Linwood, still towered over his only son despite the inches Timothy had grown in recent months. Lord Linwood tugged stiffly on his silver-threaded waistcoat, gaze moving side to side, taking in the listing boat, Marianne's wide expression, surely cataloguing each of the 21 broken rules. Silence. Charles Linwood locked eyes with him. Timothy had no confusion as to what would happen next. "Marianne, you will return to the nursery," Word said without taking his gaze from Timothy's face. Marianne whimpered. Grimly, Timothy unclasped his sister's hands from his leg and gently pushed her toward the door. Her soulful eyes lifted to his, bottom lip trembling. "All will be well, sister," he said. "Go now." Without a glance at their father, she ran into the house. Timothy studied his sire. As usual, his father's face was as expressive as granite. No trace of emotion flickered, anger or otherwise. A textbook example of rule number 37. A gentleman is always in control of himself and his situation. And its corollaries. Rule number 23. A gentleman suppresses emotion, whether of disappointment, of mortification, of laughter, of anger, etc. Rule number 59. A gentleman never allows his thoughts to be evident upon his visage. You will recite rules 303 through 309 for me. His father clasped his hands behind his back. Now, boy. Timothy swallowed, forcing his face into an impassive mask, mimicking his father's expression. Took a deep breath. Recited. Rule number 303. A gentleman does not engage in trade. Rule number 304. Mathematics should remain in a theoretical sphere. Rule number 305. A gentleman does not toil with his hands like a common labourer. Rule number 306. A gentleman does not indulge in the vulgarity of practical mathematics. Rule number 307. A gentleman does not manufacture machines either with his own hands or with the help of others. Rule number 308. A gentleman does not design or use machines to bring a good to market. As Timothy recited, Charles Linwood walked to the stone balustrade, overlooking the back gardens, rigid back to his son. You are my heir. His father did not turn around, did not raise his voice. Rule number 3. At all times, a gentleman should maintain behaviour and a demeanour which honours the illustrious heritage and sacrifices of his ancestors. His father straightened his shoulders. To engage in trade is a disgrace to the family name. Your actions reflect on us all. Eyes staring sightlessly ahead, Timothy absorbed each word as a blow. He knew. He knew how he should behave. It was spelled out, literally. Why? His father's words barely a question. Despite all my endeavours to impress upon you the importance of your duty, why do you persist in this lowering pursuit? Timothy swallowed and then locked his spine. 'Twas for Marianne's sake, sir. I wished to see my sister smile. It was at least a partial truth. Rule number 9. A gentleman always cares for the needs of his family. His father turned back to him, mouth tensed, eyes narrowed the smallest bit. An eyebrow rose slowly upward. For Charles Linwood, it was a catastrophic display of disappointment. That is a lie you tell yourself, boy. His voice deathly quiet, cutting. You made the toy because you wished to. Your sister was merely an excuse. The rules shall never be placed in contradiction with each other. That was rule number 301. If you truly care for Marianne, you will tame this proclivity. Charles Linwood continued. If you sully the Linwood name with such low habits, you will damage her prospects. Would you allow this silly infatuation to be the cause of her ruin? Timothy's heart pounded. Machines were his very breath. Ideas constantly assaulted him, flitting through his brain, restless. Numbers, gears, springs, levers. Even as his father continued to lecture, Timothy noted his father's shadow on the flagstones and, almost unwillingly, mentally triangulated the man's height, the numbers practically visible before his eyes. It grieves me greatly to see you thus, Charles was saying. I will stamp out this stain. I will mould you into a man worthy to bear the title of Lord Linwood. Do you understand? Rule number 1. A gentleman will ensure that the next generation is raised in a manner worthy of the Linwood name. There was only one answer to such a question. Yes, sir. Bring that here, boy. His father gestured toward the boat, bobbing on its side in the basin. Dutifully, Timothy picked up the toy, its metal cold against his skin. It had taken him nearly 6 months of long nights and cut hands to build. An obsession which had distracted him while he memorized Latin declensions and deciphered Homer in ancient Greek. Solemnly, he set it into his father's outstretched hand. Charles turned the toy around, studying the curved edges Timothy had carefully formed and filed down. Not a single emotion flickered across the man's impassive face. Turning, he gestured for Timothy to follow him. With deliberate precision, Charles walked down the curving rear staircase, across the large flagstones, through an arch and onto the back lawn, stopping in front of a small reflecting pond. Once there, his father set the boat adrift in the pool of water. And then, with studied casualness, the man pulled a pistol from his frock coat and handed the weapon to Timothy.
"Now you will dispatch this monstrosity. You will take this action as a metaphor for yourself, blasting away this unworthy part of you."
Charles gestured toward the toy. Timothy swallowed hard and fast. He would not cry. He never cried. He could do this. It was the barest minimum he had expected if caught. Images flooded through him, equations and metal, cause and effect, even the mechanics of the pistol he now held. As he aimed and then squeezed the trigger, his mind saw the chain of events. The flint descending, scraping along the metal frizzen, creating a spark which landed in the flash pan, igniting the primed gunpowder in a flash of sparks which travelled through the touch hole, lighting the main charge which sent the lead bullet flying from the barrel. The boat disappeared in a shower of smoke and metal fragments, some sinking into the pond, others landing on the ground around him. Timothy bit his quivering lip, focusing on the pain, the taste of blood in his mouth. Rule number 23. A gentleman suppresses emotion. A solitary gear, the boat's flywheel, rolled across the ground, coming to a stop against Timothy's boot. He stared as the steering wheel wobbled and toppled over, which meant he didn't see his father's hand coming. The blow snapped Timothy's head back, causing him to stagger. He was proud he didn't fall over, or even flinch, for that matter. And his tears stayed firmly locked away. Thank the heavens for small miracles. His sire had taught him well.
"That blow was for breaking rule number 29. A gentleman will refrain from all displays of levity. Remember, this is all for your own good, Timothy. I do not enjoy having to discipline you thus."
Rule number 77. A gentleman takes no joy in the righteous administration of just punishment.
"In time you will thank me for this day, for saving you from this baser part of your nature before it destroys everything you value, including your sister."
Timothy tracked his father's dark head as the man strode back to the house. For nearly the 1,000th time, Timothy wondered why. Why had God seen fit to give him the gift of mathematics, but then doom him to love mechanics as well? He needed to give it up, for good. Pack it away. He would not risk Marianne. She was the brightest part of his life. With their mother constantly enveloped in an opium haze and their stern father distant and absent, she was all he had. He was all she had. He would see to Marianne's future, ensure her bright smile remained undimmed. Timothy looked back down, eyes resting on the solitary gear which had landed near his boot, its spokes perfectly cut and filed. That piece alone had taken nearly 2 weeks to make. What did the Bible say? "When I was a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things." Yes. He would become the man his father wanted. In a sense, he was no more than that gear lying on the ground, a cog in the machine of history, a mindless automaton who would preserve the Linwood heritage and honor. He picked up the gear, slipping it into his coat pocket. This he would keep. A souvenir, to use the French word, a remembrance of everything he needed to stamp out of himself. There was no other way. Chapter 1. Dwyer Cottage, near the town of Marfield, Herefordshire, England, March 8th, 2015. Prince Charming, that was all Jasmine Fleury wanted. A dashing man to gallop into her life with a delectable smile and a good knack for dragon slaying. Problem solving. Namely hers. Was that too much to ask? Apparently, yes. Yes, it was. Particularly as every knight in shining armour she had come across ended up being a jerk wrapped in tin foil. Exhibit A, her current phone conversation. Can you please state your full name and place of birth? Mike's gravelly voice filled her ears. You already know all of that, Mike. Or you did. Once upon a time. Silence. Look, Jazz, I don't want this to be any more difficult than it has to be. I'm trying to be a professional here. More silence of the fraught variety. Fine. She could do this. She could be calm and collected. Professional. Jasmine's pen tap, tap, tapped as she blinked and swallowed, let out a slow breath. How could you? Okay, so maybe not so much with the calm and collected, or quite frankly, the professional. She heard a shuffle over the phone, something beeping off, and then a long sigh. Tap, tap, tap. Mike drew a deep breath. Babe, we've been over this. 2 years, 3 months, and 5 days. That's how much of my life I gave you. Jazz, I'm not ready, you said. Commitment just isn't my style. She drawled the word just as he would. But oh no, come to find out, commitment is totally your style. Audrey is totally your style. Turns out it was just me who wasn't your style. Come on, Jazz, you gotta move on. Move on? As in your definition of move on? No, thank you. Did you even wait 2 weeks after we broke up to go out with her? And now you're engaged after what? 3 months of dating? Calling you was a mistake. Audrey warned me. Unconsciously, Jasmine moved her pen over the large pad of sticky notes in front of her, doodling, her throat tightening. We were good together, she sniffed, pen still drawing. Curlicues and calligraphic letters. What? No, we weren't. We fought all the time. We were terrible. Awful. We could have made it work. We just needed to try harder. Jazz, Jazz, Jazz. She could practically see him shaking his head. If something is right, you don't have to make it work. Love isn't difficult, I know that now. Things with Audrey are effortless. But you can't fix everything and everyone, no matter how much you may want to. Jasmine swallowed and wiped her wet cheeks with her free hand. She didn't even bother trying to stem the tears. She had been known to cry over a diaper commercial. You know, the one where the baby crawled around with a puppy licking its face. Seriously, you had to be heartless to not cry. But Mike hadn't even sniffled over it. How could she have missed the signs? Stupid man. Stupid, stupid. She made an emphatic swirl with her pen. It's not like she wanted Mike back anyway. Not really. They were awful together. Gah! The misunderstandings, the stonewalling, her tears, his lack of them. It had just been the challenge of him. He had been so broken. Humpty Dumpty to her king's men. She had been convinced she could put him together again, mother him back to emotional health. Classic fixer-upper syndrome. Why hadn't she seen the breakup coming? Granted, most normal people couldn't see into the future, and it wasn't as if she had visions or anything. But when her best friend Emmy Wilde left to conduct research in Herefordshire, Jasmine had just known that Emmy would bring a husband home with her. It came to her as everything else did. A whispering sense pulsing through the ground beneath her feet. A rippling of the ocean of the universe. Jasmine could generally sense the life force of everyone to some degree. Others' lives lapped against her, wrapped around her, tugged her into the web of humanity. But with those close to her, like Emmy, the sense extended from mere awareness to something akin to vision. She had seen Emmy's life circle reaching out to intertwine with another, slipping through the cracks of time itself. And sure enough, Emmy had shown up 3 months later with James Knight in tow. The two had been married for nearly 3 years now and had a darling 5-month-old boy, Arthur. Granted, there was the small matter of James having been born a 19th-century aristocrat at nearby Halden Manor, and that little something in the cellar of Dwyer Cottage which had made Emmy and James's love match possible. Emmy's brother, Mark, had found his soulmate the same way, whisked away and returning with Kit at his side. Jasmine had attended his wedding to Kit Ashton over the holidays, and as Kit had walked up the aisle to Mark, both looking so radiant and happy, Jasmine had felt the relentless destiny of the moment. The tendrils of life twirling around them, as if Mark and Kit being together had been decreed eons before. Why could she never see the course of her own life so clearly? Despite their differences, Jasmine had really thought Mike was the one. Wow, had she been wrong? So here she was, 32 years old and starting all over, trying to meet guys, being set up on blind dates, her life full of all sorts of junior high-like awkwardness, her own happily ever after just as far out of reach, and no sense that it would ever happen. Jasmine, I really don't need to hear this. What? You're doing that ranting thing of yours, you know, where you talk out your internal monologue? Humpty Dumpty? Really? And what is this about lives intertwined and James being a 19th-century aristocrat? Wait, no. She had been thinking that, not talking. Nope, you were talking. I got all of it. And for the record, I don't think I was ever the one. Jasmine groaned, feeling the telltale burn on her cheeks. Why did mortification have to actually hurt? And when would she ever learn, still talking, babe?
Harg!
I'm so sorry, Mike. You know how I am. Trust me, I do. Still working on those filters, eh? He had no idea. Jasmine set down her pen and purposefully pinched her lips, holding them between her fingers. Her grandma, Mommy, had made Jasmine do that as a child when Jasmine couldn't seem to separate her thoughts from her voice. She had gradually outgrown the bad habit, but stressful situations brought it roaring back. And given how everything had gone down with Mike, Jasmine had not been her best self in recent months. In fact, it had been Emmy who had suggested her current stay in Dwyer Cottage. After the breakup, Jasmine had wanted to get as far away from Mike as possible. Bless Emmy's sweetheart. She knew that when bad things happened, Jasmine needed space. A getaway. The quaint cottage that James owned in rural Herefordshire had called to her. The house always had, though this was her first time visiting. English countryside picturesque, with a gabled roof and honeystone half covered in wisteria, the cottage pulsed with energy. The building had sighed in welcome when she arrived. The sinuous oak branches carved into the front door mimicked the swirling strands of energy she sensed encircling the cottage, as if the time portal thrumming in the cellar imbued the structure with a palpable energy, a rippling circle of awareness that felt nearly sentient. Tendrils wrapping through and around each soul, drawing lives together. Still holding her lips, Jasmine glanced up from her drawing and looked at the open-concept kitchen-slash-dining-slash-sitting-room. Age-darkened beams cut across the whitewashed ceiling, lit in sharp relief by a bank of paned windows to the right. The marble countertop was cool under her hand, the stainless steel appliances a quiet hum. She looked down the room toward the looming fireplace at the opposite end, so tall she could practically stand up in it. Though at only 5'2", she was short enough to stand upright inside most things. Between the kitchen island and the fireplace, there was an expanse of rough-hewn dining table, overstuffed sofa, and matching wing-back chairs. All cluttered with dirty dishes, doodled sticky notes, graphite pencils, books, unfolded laundry, the remains of takeaway tikka masala, and a bag of vintage clothing finds from Oxfam in Hereford. Yeah, it was probably time to straighten up. Funny, she had no problem tolerating physical messiness. But emotional upheaval? Not so much. She knew what she needed to do. Man up, put on her big girl pants. Let the situation with Mike go. She looked down at her sticky pad and then froze, studying what she had written. Wow. Talk about karma. Just when she needed it most, the universe sent her a sign. Bless the universe. It was always doing things like this. The words, drawn in scrolling calligraphy, surrounded by paisley swirls. Trust the process. Marmee's voice drifted through her mind, a fleeting whiff of lavender, the hushed sense of a hand touching her hair. And then it was gone. Jasmine took in a deep breath, sending up silent thanks for the small gift, eyes pooling again. Jazz, you still there? Yeah. Wait, lips? Yeah, she said breathlessly, wiggling her mouth to bring feeling back. Mike cleared his throat. Look, if this is too hard, I can try to find another way. She could hear the pleading in his voice. He really didn't want to find another way. But we started down this path a year ago, and my dissertation committee is excited about the research. They're already talking publication. Our personal history aside, this research is fascinating. Would you be willing to give it a try? Please? He knew right where to strike. Knew she couldn't resist the plea for help. She was such a bleeding heart. Trust the process. She still stared at the words. Could she? Like exercise and teeth flossing, knowing you needed to do something didn't automatically make it happen. Deep breath. More wiping of her face. Phew. Still not talking out loud. See? Progress. They were over and done. Jasmine and Mike. Never to be. She wasn't getting him back. Didn't really want him back. It was going to be okay. She could do this again. Meet someone, move through the initial awkwardness, build a relationship, find that right man who wanted to build a life together. Trust the process. With a determined lift of her chin, she picked up the sticky note and strode around to the fridge, slapping the paper onto its surface, right next to another sticky note which read, "Crying over a guy? Pick your head up, princess. Your tiara is slipping." Exactly. Positive thinking. Karma. Let the universe bring back to her what she gave to it. Mike had dumped her, but she could be gracious. Forgiving. Kind. Sure, she heard herself say around the lump in her throat. One more sniffle. You're right. I want to know, too. Good. His relief was palpable, even through the long-distance connection. She heard a shuffle and another beep. Okay, I have the recorder turned back on. I'm just documenting this for research reference. Could you clearly state your name and place of birth? Right. Clinical, professional. Just the facts, ma'am. Jasmine O'Reilly Fleury, born in Boston, Massachusetts, on June 21st, 1983. Thank you. Could you tell me a little about your family? Jazz took in a steadying breath. Sure. My parents were John and O'Reilly Fleury. I am, or was, I suppose, the youngest of three children. You use past tense. What happened? She closed her eyes. Mike knew all of this, of course. But for the research. My family was killed in a car accident in January of 1990, just outside Gainesville, Florida, when I was 7 years old. We were living in Florida at the time and had just spent the day at Disney World. It was...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?